Thank you, Sarah, for inviting me to make this response tonight. And you've delighted us over these four episodes with your deft storytelling and your comments on literary nuances and social and cultural customs that have enriched that experience. It's a bit of a hard act to follow, but I'll see what I can do. From our conversation, I gather that the idea is, in revisiting Ruth's tale, we're trying to create a space where we can deepen our connection with the story. The wonderful thing about stories is that there is always more to be gleaned from a text, and that includes our lives as text. We can lose some of the treasure or the pickings if we move on too quickly to the next instalment. Perhaps a summary might help to take us back into the story. I know it did for me. In the prologue, we hear how Naomi, her husband, Elimelech, and their rather inauspiciously named sons, Mahlon and Chilion, have left Bethlehem in Judea to go to the land of Moab to escape famine. There, disaster strikes, and Naomi loses not only her husband, but her two sons. For women at that time, this was particularly disastrous because it represented not only an emotional loss, but a loss of social and economic security. In Naomi's case, this was exacerbated by being an outsider in a foreign land without kin or rights. So, hearing that the famine in Bethlehem has passed, Naomi decides to return home. Although she attempts to discourage them, her two daughters-in-law insist on accompanying her. Orpah is eventually persuaded to return to her family, but Ruth insists on staying with her in words of such great beauty and noble intent that I can't resist reading them in full. Do not press me to leave you or to turn back from following you. Where you go, I will go. Where you lodge, I will lodge. Your people shall be my people, and your God, my God. Where you die, I will die. There will I be buried. May the Lord do thus and so to me, and more as well, if even death parts me from you. Their return to Bethlehem coincides with the time of the barley harvest, and Ruth goes out to glean in the fields. She just happens to find herself in the field of Boaz, a rich relative of Naomi, and hence a potential kinsman redeemer who could offer them economic security. And it just so happens that Boaz is a thoroughly decent man who is going to behave honourably. One thing leads to another, with not a little help from the resourceful scheming or strategizing on the part of both Ruth and Naomi. Ruth becomes Boaz's wife, and Boaz becomes Naomi's kinsman redeemer. Everyone seems set to live happily ever after. All loose ends are tied up. In the coda to the story, Naomi, who has lost two sons, is even given a replacement son for her old age. When Obed, Ruth and Boaz's firstborn, arrives, the women say to Naomi, "Blessed be the Lord who has not left you this day without next of kin. He shall be a restorer of life and nourisher of your old age. For your daughter-in-law, who is more to you than seven sons, has borne him." Then the women of the neighbourhood gave him a name, saying, "A son has been born to Naomi." This short passage is interesting because it points to the significant part played by women throughout the whole story. Despite a patriarchal context that afforded no economic or social security for women apart from being under male protection. I've already referred to Ruth and Naomi's proactive participation in pursuing the betrothal with Boaz. In the above extract, the women are like some Greek chorus interpreting Naomi's story for her and for us, in case we haven't got it. They also remind us that the relationship between Ruth and Naomi is arguably the central relationship in the story. You could say it is the real love story. This raises an interesting question. Why make Ruth the outsider, the undoubted hero of the text? I could have said heroine, but I preferred to say hero. I thought she deserved it. In providing a genealogy for King David, the coda also reminds us that this family story fits into a much larger story, the story of God's people. Obed is to be the father of Jesse, who in turn is the father of David. This raises another interesting question, about the relationship between myth and history for the writers of the story, if this story is based on a folk tale, as many modern scholars believe. So what does this story offer us today, beyond enjoyment of a well-told tale and a glimpse into an ancient culture and its social relationships and obligations? Are there themes that emerge from the story itself and the way it is told that may still resonate with us several thousand years down the track? Sometimes these themes are readily accessible. For example, the themes of loyalty, steadfastness, and love emerge from the character of Ruth and her commitment to Naomi. Other themes emerge more subtly through the narrative structure and language patterns, particularly the use of repetitions and polarities or binary oppositions. For example, fullness and emptiness. Naomi says to her kinsfolk on her return from Moab, "Call me no longer Naomi, call me Mara, for the Almighty has dealt bitterly with me. I went away full, but the Lord has brought me back empty." She seems to forget that she and her family left Bethlehem because of famine, but in terms of family, she was full at that time, having a husband and two sons. Other binaries seem to be variations on this theme, and the overarching one seems to be that of home and exile. It is in returning home to Bethlehem from exile in Moab that abundance replaces scarcity, celebration replaces grief, fullness replaces emptiness, feast replaces famine, marriage and fruitfulness replace bereavement and barrenness. The trouble is with neat binaries is that they don't allow for the fluidity of our lived experience. Even within the biblical text, they are challenged. After all, it is the outsider Ruth who enables Naomi to come home and who is instrumental in the restoration of her fortunes on so many levels. Yet, for Ruth, it is not a return to a home she has left. In what sense, then, is Ruth coming home? Maybe there are clues to that in the beautiful oath that I read out that she makes to Naomi. And perhaps that oath is not just to Naomi, but to some deeper calling within her. As tonight's Ecclesiastes reading suggests, there are seasons in our lives. There is a time for everything, and a season for every activity under the heavens. Sometimes we find ourselves in the place of celebration and harvest. We fall in love, we have children, we at last find a job that fits our sense of vocation, we find a community of apparently like-minded people, and so on. At such times we can feel that we have at last found our place, our reason for being here. It all comes together. But there will be lean times, wilderness times, times of bereavement and struggle. Relationships may be lost through death or the inability to keep faith. Or if not lost, then strained and challenged. The dream job turns into, if not a nightmare, then something less than it promised. Or loss of health or life stage means we need to leave that job. Communities and organisations develop cracks. And even if the externals don't disappoint or change, an inner sense of restlessness can leave us feeling stuck when we want to move on. Not only are there seasons in our lives, but the weather can change from hour to hour. Christian Wiman in My Bright Abyss speaks of the delights and demolitions of daily life. So where is that happy ever after we secretly hope for? Perhaps it is less a matter of happy ever after than trusting in the words of Dame Julian of Norwich, all will be well, all manner of thing will be well, or in the words of Dame Edith Sitwell during the Second World War, I believe, nothing is lost, all in the end is harvest. The all is also there in St. Paul's words, and we know that all things work together for good to those who love God, who are called according to his purpose. It is often only in hindsight that we can see that this is so, that what we would have preferred not to have had in our lives has in fact borne fruit. And this is more likely to happen if we have developed practices of reflecting on our lives, gleaning what we can from what comes our way. Sometimes, though, it's better not to try to make sense of things too quickly, but to be fully present, to come home to where we are right now, even if it is in the midst of a mess. To come home to where we are right now in the unfolding story that is both our story and a much larger story. I would like to conclude with some lines from Pierre Teilhard de Chardin, brought to the attention of the theology group by Peter Yule during the week. Above all, trust in the slow work of God. We are quite naturally impatient in everything to reach the end without delay. We should like to skip the intermediate stages. We are impatient of being on the way to something unknown, something new. And yet it is the law of all progress that it is made by passing through some stages of instability, and that it may take a very long time.